Here's a question for you. When was the last time you felt protected? You felt safe from suffering, from harm. How did you get there? How hungry were you to stay there? There's a restlessness in us around the idea of, will we be protected from suffering, from loss, from all those things that seem to come so easily into the lives of human beings? Today, we talk with Jeff Crosby, a dear friend of mine, an author, and someone who has had a history in publishing for most of his life and most of his career. He is a friend of books, and he is a friend of music and of words, but also he's a person with a great deal of wisdom about how we live in the light of suffering, how we live in the light of protection. And there is a restlessness in us, that's for sure, around whether or not we will be protected. And wouldn't you know it, I think that restlessness is actually a gift. Jeff, I am so glad we get to do this conversation. You were one of the people who read this book, some of the earliest chapters, and gave such incredible feedback, but also just, you know, over the years, being able to work with you and writing in books and formation and publishing and that whole big world that we've been in. But this conversation is just a blessing. So I'm glad you made the time to do it. Thank you for doing that.
I'm grateful to be asked, Casey.
Yeah. The podcast is called Restlessness is a Gift. And, you know, there's always a debate. Do you believe that? Do you not? But I'd more like to know a bit of your perspective on that word. I've known you to be a person who loves words. Even the opening chapter of your book talks about words, how important words are. I'm curious how you feel about that word. How does that word sit with you today?
I think my relationship with restlessness has changed over time. I think there was a time when I equated restlessness with discontent, with something to be avoided. Perhaps even early in my Christian life as an adult convert, something that may have suggested, you know, sin in one's life. If you're restless, you're not thankful, you're not living in the present moment, and that sort of thing. And over time, I have seen, and one of the reasons I loved your book so much, I have seen that restlessness actually can be a gift. That there are times, I believe, when God uses our restlessness or maybe even prompts it in order for us to grow. It's a bit like the pruning of the viburnum shrub out front of my house that, you know, every year there's a pruning. There's a time where that is done, and that produces fruit, that produces growth in that viburnum the following season. So it is definitely, this relationship to the word has evolved to the point of where your idea of it being seen as a gift didn't seem at all foreign to me. It seemed very much a part of my experience.
So what shifted that for you? Was it time? Were there particular experiences? I mean, it may be all of the above, but what was it? Is there something you could point to say that's really the moment where I made a switch over from this is sin or this is just discontentment to, gosh, this may actually be something worth embracing, investigating?
Yeah, I think it's as my reading, as you know, Casey, I've spent all of my adult life working with books, working with words, and at first as a bookseller and then as a publisher for many, many years. I think that it is as my reading shifted from the early days of very didactic, apologetics kind of reading, argumentative reading that enabled me to have an answer for every question that would be posed to me. and even some that weren't ever posed to me. I think as my reading shifted from that, largely through the early influence of Richard Foster's Celebration of Discipline, but then other things that built on that from Dallas Willard, James Bryan Smith, Ruth Haley Barton, and other people, all of whom you would know them personally, or at least their work, you know, and the, they tended to the interior life. As I moved from my head to my heart, not that the head knowledge wasn't still important, but it was that move. I'm very much influenced by both music and by reading. And I see, I see as I think back on my journey, how I shifted in my 30s. In fact, as you know, when I shifted away from a longtime job at InterVarsity Press where we first met, I had to trim my library because I was going from a very large office to this office. And I gave away about 1,200, 1,300 volumes of books because I simply had no space. And as I boxed those books up and I put them out for my colleagues to take, and then donations to libraries and churches, I could see the questions that I had in my 20s, my 30s, my 40s, my 50s. And I could see that shift. And I think that's what happened. It was a movement from an intellectual faith to that plus an experiential, a formational, a discipline or practices kind of faith that brought about a greater embrace of restlessness, not as something to be avoided, but as something to embrace. And then also watching how in moments of restlessness, when I responded, what happened? And how even in shifting vocation a couple of times amid great risk, what happened? How did God use those risky steps for good in my own life, my family's life, and the world, I hope?
The getting rid of books thing, I know it's a small detail, but my goodness, and there are people listening to this that won't understand what I'm about to say at all. My guess is most people will, but there is a unique ache in cleaning out your library. I have to make a calendar item to say on this day, you've got to prune some things.
Yeah.
And I think it connects kind of to the language of the book, which is, when we're in restless places, it's because we know we can't go back, but we have no idea what happens next. And so I put the book in the box and I'm like, I know that I could have that in 2 days from Amazon, but, or from another publisher, from whomever, but if I get rid of it now, what if I need it?
Yes.
What if I need to come back to that and it's gone? And there is some of that that's like, do I really want to? And it has always been, I've never found myself in a period of like deep, dark regret over cleaning the library. But you're right. Those questions and how they grow, how they change, how we change in response to them. It kind of feels like we would always be a heretic to our younger selves. They would look at us and go, you're not so serious about your faith. What's wrong with you? But there's that growth and maturity aspect.
Well, I can tell you there have been a few books that were given away that have been replaced because I learned that I couldn't live without them. But for the most part, we've kept them away.
Yeah. You are the first, one of the first people, not the only, but one of the first people I knew who really expressed a conversational love, and even in stuff that you've written, for Frederick Buechner.
Yeah.
And it really encouraged me. I can tell just from how you talk about his writing and his work that he was important to you. And Buechner was always the person who I think he always said things in a way that I wasn't expecting. He always framed things differently. And there's a lot that he had to say about safety and protection. So part of what I wanted to talk to you about today was, you know, there's a chapter in the book about that. I have two sump pumps in the basement and then one just went off. So let me pause. And there's a chapter in the book about protection, about what it means to be safe. And you captured a quote from Buechner on that yeah. I would love to talk to you about and see how that hit you as a person who really appreciates his work as well as I do. You kind of introduced me to that. So.
Yeah, well, for those who don't know Buechner's work, I imagine many of your listeners do, but he experienced the death of his father at a very young age, death by suicide. And I believe Frederick may have been 12, but he was quite young. And so suffering entered his life at an early age. And I think a lot of his work, a lot of his writing and his speaking throughout his life, and he just passed away in the last year, I believe, a lot of his work was wrestling with questions about beauty and suffering and how that's all held in tension. One of his memoirs, I believe this is what you're referring to, where it's often quoted and put up on social media these days, but you really want to go and get the whole quote. But part of it says, the grace of God means something like this. Here is your life. You might never have been, but you are, because the party wouldn't have been complete without you. And here is the world. Beautiful and terrible things will happen. Don't be afraid. I'm with you. Nothing can ever separate us. And his words seem to suggest that we really can't be protected. And in the chapter, you're wrestling with the longing you felt to be protected, the longing you felt, and I'm sure continue to feel, to protect Bailey, your daughter. I think that we simply can't avoid suffering. The world is beautiful, but it's also terrible. Mm. Both Buechner as well as Scripture tells us repeatedly, though, to be not afraid. And so, I'm curious to know. I mean, you're wrestling with that in the chapter, but with the benefit of some distance from writing it, what do you make of that? How do you live in the tension of those twin realities of beauty and suffering? I think Buechner wrestled with that question his entire life.
Yeah, I don't know that I have it resolved. So part of my world is writing. Part of my world is spiritual direction. Part of it is a pastor role. And this is the question of suffering. It's always on the front of our minds and people's minds that I work with. And it's no more or less, probably more actually, was it on my mind in that 2020 through 2022, 21-22 period that really the book is talking about. And the suffering just felt like if someone could just build a shield around us, it's almost as if you might be content with suffering to continue. And this is just vulnerability here. You would be content for suffering to happen, at least on a level, everywhere else, as long as it wasn't happening where you are. And there's that immediately piques my compassion for us. And I just immediately think of that image and go, okay, well, that's not great. That's not helpful. But there are when you're in that moment where suffering is at its, like, is at a 10, a level 10 out of 10, you do feel like if someone could just protect me, if there is just a safe place for me to go and hide from this for a while. And I think some, you know, as I talk to people about their responses to 2020, some people did that. Mm-hmm. They felt, sometimes it's because they had family members who were immunocompromised, like I do. Sometimes it was because of the way that they approached the whole conversation politically, how they felt about what what was the virus and was it real? And were people, you know, are people just making things up and it's really not as dangerous as it seems? Your level of safety sort of fluctuates based on what you really feel like is happening. And sometimes that's based on good information. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's just a matter of resilience. I've, you know, found people who judge their level of safety based on what they've gone through in the past and how they've worked through it. But when it comes back around to that discussion of faith and suffering, it then goes to the, if the divine is good, then why does this kind of thing happen? Why do the things that happened to my daughter happen? Why do the things that happened to people's jobs that I knew or people's families that I knew, why do these things happen? And I think the only way to resolve it is, I don't know that there is a way to resolve it. I do think the best way forward I'm going to use this word real loosely, the safest way forward is just to name that, is just to say, I trust that the divine is good, and I also have an issue with suffering. And sometimes I don't want it to happen to anyone but me, or everyone but me. I didn't say that right. Sometimes I would rather it happen everywhere else but here. And just acknowledging that and letting that cement us, like that was my present tense. So I talk about cocooning up in 2020. That was it. It was, if I just turn inward emotionally, mentally, relationally, and not leave the house, you know, because everybody else is saying don't leave the house, so I can do that. But what it ended up doing was this quest for safety turned me inward. And, you know, relationships, there are still relationships right now that I feel like I'm trying to rebuild after that period of time. I don't know. I don't know how that strikes you, Jeff, how you would feedback on that idea.
Yeah. Well, I most people I know cocooned in those months to some extent. I think you write about it more vulnerably than most.
You know, I also know people who, like, that was their most creative, like they had this output, like this extreme burst. So that was even worse, because then it's like I'm huddling up and this other person's like, I'm making everything that I wanted to make for the last 10 years and now I have the time to do it. So it's an odd feeling to be like, I just got to turn in, and they're like, turn in. I'm hitting the gas. This is the best time ever. But.
Well, there definitely was a lot of creativity around baking bread and and things like that. And, you know, people posted their most creative cooking or woodworking or whatever on social media, and made us think that they were in their happy zone. And maybe some were, but I do think that what we went through affected all of us, yes, in different ways, but there is no one who will be honest, I would say, who will not acknowledge that there was loss in that. You know, I just read a book co-authored by my friend Marilyn McIntyre called The Mindful Grandparent, or Mindful Grandparenting. The most extraordinary book, written as yours was in the midst of the pandemic. And the chapters that these two women, Marilyn McIntyre and Shirley Showalter, are their names. It's also published by Broadleaf, as is your book and mine. It's just the chapters on what they experienced during that time of distance, of isolation from, I think one of them has 8 grandchildren and the other 6. It just brought back so many memories for me of the distance with my own 6 grandchildren, particularly the 2 who live nearby, where we were standing out in the driveway, you know, and making our heart symbols with our hands, you know, and things like that. So I think what you're naming in this chapter of your cocooning period is, it's incredibly honest. I think it is something that the majority of your readers are going to identify with. But one of the questions I have for you as I read it is,
what helped you to come out of the cocoon? that you placed yourself in as a result of your longing for protection? What were the things that prompted you to do that in your memory?
Well, the non-glorious answer is necessity. Just the need to find my way back to something that felt normal, knowing that that's, you know, there is no such thing as that. Holly shared a quote with me during the whole writing of the book and the process of coming back, and said, at some point the old structure doesn't fit, you need a new one. But in a lot of ways it's the same, it's similar. It's not exactly the same. And normal is the new normal. We try to use that phrase all the time, but it's like having a surgery. You go back to functioning again, but you have this scar, and that's always going to be there. It's always going to remind you, but there was a necessity just to come back to being active in work and writing. We started meeting with people in person again, and there were people who we had missed as part of our life, and we wanted to be back. So there was a desire there to move back into those places. So I think that was part of it. Mm-hmm. The other was I had gotten to the point where my energy tank had started to fill back up again. For whatever reason, you know, I don't know that I can find one. I think I started reading better. I'm the person that if I'm reading poorly, or not reading at all, it's just draining. Like if I'm refilling the tank, that's really helpful.
Yeah.
And then wanting to communicate, you know, feeling the call to communicate, not that the call makes it sound overly dramatic, but just this pulling, this invitation from the divine to communicate, this is what I've experienced, and feeling okay about doing that. I think vulnerability is an interesting thing, because sometimes we do it way too quickly, and we are, you know, especially communicators and writers, sometimes we are way too vulnerable too fast, and it's hard to say things with hopefulness and clarity when you get too quickly to talking about that deep, dark stuff. And then sometimes we don't do it quickly enough. Mm-hmm. And it sort of sits on the shelf and gets moldy, and it doesn't have the same life to it. And so feeling that sense of this is alive right now.
Yeah.
I've walked through it as much as I can, but also I know a bit about how I want to say this. So I think there were a lot of factors that come to it. And as I think about people who I know have gone through the process of feeling unsafe, their safety has been threatened. I don't know that there's a map for how, you know, the divine invites them back, almost like being invited back into your own life, and rebuilding trust, rebuilding your energy, with some new knowledge and some new wisdom. So yeah, I don't know what exactly helped, but I knew there were a lot of things that sort of got behind me and gently, the gentle shove, if you will, back out into the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's good. I think probably for many of us, there was an amalgamation of factors that brought it about. Could we shift over to your mantra that you talk about in the chapter? For those of you who have not read it yet, it's the two words, of course. And as I read that portion of the chapter, I thought, I've been with Casey when he has said those two words to me, you know. So that mantra precedes your cocooning. It precedes the pandemic. It's something that's been with you for a good while. Talk to me more about, but I never heard you identify. It was just words that you would say to me in conversation. But in the context of the chapter and the larger narrative there, it really provoked the curiosity on my part of, you know, tell me more about that. And how does that help you? How does that work for you? What is it about, of course, that sort of resets things for you?
Well, I heard a filmmaker recently say that good artists borrow and great artists steal.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do have to give credit. That is a Rob Bell phrase that I heard him use kind of in passing on a podcast. And it really stuck. And for me, it's representative of things. It's representative of a wisdom, of a kind of wisdom. For me, it's knowing not only how I would respond, but also knowing what I know of life, the world, other people, of God, self, and others, you know, the things that I've learned over the years. And a lot of it, you know, I joke that my best learning style is the hard way, whichever way that is. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of this I've earned through scars and bumps and bruises. But being able, what I noticed is that part of the cocooning was the other thing that came about in it was I was easily moved to outrage over things. Mm. So, you know, 20 was a heightened, the last 5 years have been 6 years have been a heightened political time, social time. If you have any presence on social media, you get to see this like seething immediate, no one seems to have a fuse anymore. And I think what happened for me is I began to see how much just saying, of course, helped me to sort of cut that outrage off at the root. Because if something happens and a person from a political or a specific perspective says something that I know is consistent with what I know of the world or what I know of that person, I could just be like, I can't believe this happened. Or I could just say, well, of course. Of course, that's exactly what happened. Or if I see myself reacting a certain way, I mean, we're swimming in resources on self-knowledge, you know, from the Enneagram to having a spiritual director to I've taken the DISC assessment and the Working Genius assessment. And there are all these things that want to tell you things about yourself. To me, the best thing that I could do with that is when I respond in this way that I know I'm going to respond, being able to say, of course, that's how you'd respond to that. And then being able to say, now that you've normalized that, now that you've just called that what it is, and I really feel like this has been a conversation with spirit over time. So being able to say, of course, and then have the spirit say, yeah, so that's a normal thing. You know that. What do we do now? You know, how do we move into this with grace? How do you respond differently than flipping into outrage or shutting down or whatever it is that you do when these moments happen? So that's where that mm-hmm. has been really helpful. But there are situations I think that are universal, that are wonderful, of course, moments. There are people I know, and I've talked to organizations, all kinds of organizations, and it seems like this happens the exact same way. You get that email that says, hey, can we talk?
Mm-hmm.
And then the signature. And no one goes, oh, I'm so excited for that conversation. No one I know does that. They all go, uh-oh, what does that mean? Yeah. Especially if it's, you know, someone you report to. Or if it's a significant other and they say, we need to talk. You're like, oh, that is never about like an inheritance or a great vacation. That always feels like it's about something that you don't want to enter into. But just being able to say, well, of course I would respond that way. I don't have all the information. I don't know what's happening. I should be prepared for just about anything. But being able to step in that in a different way can be really, really helpful. Mm-hmm. And if you feel unsafe in that moment, I feel unsafe in that moment. So some of saying, of course, is to kind of ground me and say, yeah, you feel unprotected and vulnerable because you don't know what's about to happen, or you know exactly what's going to happen. So rather than flip out, try to correct it with your words or with your anger. And there's a place for anger. I'm not saying there isn't a place for righteous anger or indignation or having an emotion even about it.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, taking that first step of saying, of course, allows me to stay in that restlessness for a bit longer and learn from it rather than immediately fight or flighting and sometimes making a bigger mess than was intended. Hey there, just breaking in for a minute. I know, commercials are annoying, but I wanted to tell you, the book that this podcast is based on, The Gift of Restlessness, A Spirituality for Unsettled Seasons, is available for pre-order right now. So if you're listening and you haven't done that, would you please consider pre-ordering the book? And it helps it get out into the world and helps it get into people's algorithms and all of that good stuff. But if you do pre-order, I also want to give you some gifts. And so if you are a person who pre-orders the book, or if you've already pre-ordered the book, you can go to my website, kctigra.com, and register for some free gifts we have to offer you. And I would love, love to hear what you think of the book after you get it, after you get a chance to read it. So thanks for hearing this. I know commercials again are annoying, but thanks for listening to this. Back to the conversation.
Yeah, a therapist that I've spoken to a number of times talks about in moments of anxiety. She attempts to give her clients tools to use. Things that are just, we might call them practices or disciplines in times of heightened anxiety, a toolkit that we can reach into to help us. And so I think, of course, is kind of your version of that for moments in your life where you're seeing things that maybe you wish you didn't see, but of course you're going to see them. So thank you. I appreciate the elaboration on that. It was one of the parts of the chapter that stood out.
And I think it connects well too with your book that's coming out is on longing and desire. And I think there is a resonance between what happens in me when I need to use that phrase and my deepest longings and desires. Because in some ways saying, of course, is helping me get clear so that I can continue to pursue. Like my real desire is to be a person of peace. And that doesn't happen when you just decide to do it. It happens when you feel the lack of that. However you would define the lack of peace. My desire is to, when those moments come up, respond in a way that is graceful and peaceful. My longing is for that. And so that's the work that you've done. How does the Of Course toolkit play into that idea of longing and desire? Where do you see those things intersect?
Yeah, well, I think what I've tried to do in this book, which is called The Language of the Soul, is to look at 10 things, 10 longings that I believe are universal, at least 9 of them. The last one, the last chapter is the longing for heaven. And, I'm not sure that I would suggest that's universal, at least not consciously so. But the others, things like the longing for home and the longing for peace, the longing for forgiveness, I think are fairly universal regardless of one's faith tradition or absence of that. And so I think what I'm attempting to do within each of those 10 longings is to address the ways in which my concept of God has met me and others that I know within them. So in a similar way that restlessness, I think many of us have had a complicated relationship with the word restless. I think that we've also had a complicated relationship with desire or with longing. At what point does it become navel-gazing and self-absorption and sinfulness? And so really, I'm trying to look at that. And in the same way that I think you are, restlessness, what do we do with the desires that we have? And how does God meet us in the midst of those? And so in each of the 10, there are practices or disciplines, experiences that that I attempt to recount. The one that comes closest to your chapter 6, Will We Be Protected, is the chapter on the longing for freedom from fear and anxiety. I think the overlap is quite significant between the two. And as I have reread your manuscript and particularly that chapter, it was almost as if I was hearing you and our conversations in my ears as I was writing about anxiety and fear. It's not always a bad thing to be fearful. We want our children to be fearful of the flame on the stove, right? But oftentimes our anxieties, our fears, can become overwhelming and counterproductive or destructive. And so how does God meet us in the midst of those? So I think there is a similarity to what you're trying to do with restlessness. It's just some different themes that I'm grappling with. So
that's why I think when you talked about times, it seems like there's an ebb and flow to our feelings of safety. And, just a disclaimer, mm-hmm. I'm not ignorant of the fact that there are people groups in our country and in our world who never feel safe in a certain definition, who always feel like they are vulnerable, able to be attacked, and people who do it will probably get away with it. And so I don't mean to gloss over any of that, but to take it down to that sort of granular human level, it seems like there is a bit of an ebb and flow too. There are times when we feel very much protected and cared for, and then there are times. And so at the end of the book, I started to talk a bit about seasons, the literal seasons, fall, winter, spring, right. Summer. Both of us dwelling in Illinois, we have different perspectives about that. Winter is sort of like 90% of our year, either from an emotional or a literal like days on the calendar standpoint. And then my listeners in California are like, oh, that sounds terrible. And they have no sympathy for us whatsoever. But I believe Midwesterners are built of sterner stuff. So that's what I'm clinging on to. But I feel like you asked about coming out of the cocoon. I do feel like there's a season mm-hmm. that matches up with that. For me, I feel like I'm moving from winter to spring. Because as I started reading about winter, we seem to think of winter as a dead time. And in some ways it is, but there are millions of buds actually growing underneath the surface of the earth all winter long.
Absolutely.
And so I feel like this is a season where I'm moving from winter to spring, where there's some things popping up through the ground again. There's a sense of confidence returning. I was not terribly confident in my gifts and abilities for a couple years, partly because I wasn't able to use them in the ways that I had hoped. And so being able to see little grass shoots kind of picking through the dirt. And I think every writer has those moments where they write a chapter and they're like, this is great. And then they write another one and are like, I should stop this right now. This is terrible. So I'm seeing more of the former than I am the latter, although the latter is definitely still there. Seeing more of the former popping through. Is there a season that you feel matches you right now with where you are and where you're moving through in life?
Yeah, well, I always think of autumn as my my favorite season. That doesn't answer your question. I'll come to that in a moment. Exactly why autumn is, I carry it with me that is, if I could live in that season all year long, I probably would. It's a time of both dying and growing. Unlike the other three seasons in my perspective. And but in my life right now, I would say it's more of a spring to summer kind of season. I'm doing what is still, after nearly 18 months, fairly new work. And like the pruning that we've talked about, that brings new life. The writing, The new work has allowed the freedom and the margin to do a lot more writing and speaking, which also brings life. And so I would say, it's a spring to summer kind of season, but I believe no matter where we live, whether it's in Northern Illinois, where it's very cold today, or in California, where it never gets cold, we all live and have our being in seasons in life. And I do think your book beautifully, you know, lifts that out and is drawing from sources that think about how to deal with restlessness in various seasons. I think spring to summer, just because of new things that are happening and that are opening up as a result of some risks that were taken, including giving away those 1,200 or 1,300 books, and the rewards that happen. Now, that doesn't mean that every risk adventure that we set out on is going to have a spring to summer kind of results, but I would say that's where things are for me right now. But I still am partial to autumn, partial to James Taylor's October Road and September Grass. And
that's so funny, like that. Because as you started on that, I think about music, and there's like an autumn quality to music. I think there's especially the kind of music, mm-hmm. I think you and I jive with sometimes, which is that singer, that James Taylor-ness, that singer songwriter campfire, yeah. Acoustic guitar,
right?
There is a fall feeling to it as it plays. But I so appreciate you being a conversation partner and just giving great feedback on this book and having this conversation with me today, and also what you've written on desire. I think the desire longing conversation needs to continue. There are still plenty of people who look at their desires and their longings, and they either feel like they need to detach from them, or that they're somehow wrong or sinful. And you know, anything that's good taken to its negative end can be dangerous, but that doesn't mean we get rid of it. Yeah. So I thank you for your voice and your friendship. Yeah. I really do.
Likewise. It's good to be with you, Casey, and I appreciate your work. Look forward to seeing the book, you know, make an impact in the months and years ahead.
Jeff Crosby is an organizational leader in the world of words, ideas, and book publishing. Currently, he's the president and CEO of a trade association of publishers, and he has served in various executive roles, including as vice president at Ingram Book Company and at InterVarsity Press, a publisher in the Chicago area. He combines a background in journalism, leadership studies, and business with a love of language and insight from several fields, in exploring faith and spirituality in light of applied practice. He and his wife of more than 40 years, Cindy, have 2 grown children and 6 grandchildren. His book, The Language of the Soul, comes out on May 23rd, so please head to your favorite bookseller and pre-order a copy today. There's also a link for that in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Please, if you haven't already, like, subscribe, and share this podcast. And if you feel like writing a review, we would love that as well. Just helps it get into people's worlds and gets them a chance to hear what's being said and what's being talked about. And so as you go into this week, may you know the safety and protection of the God, the divine, who meets us in our restlessness. Peace, friends.